welcome to NC Spin, an unrehearsed discussion about issues of interest to North Carolina. Now here's the host of NC Spin, Tom Campbell.
Thank you for joining this week's NC Spin. We've got a lot to cover, beginning with teachers threatening to strike and a judge declaring we're leaving too many students behind, ordering schools to do more. Monday was Martin Luther King Day, and we wonder what he would say about civil rights today as remarks from our lieutenant governor about Planned Parenthood emerge. And of course, we asked the panel to tell us something we don't know. This week's panel includes Rufus Edmiston, former Secretary of State and former Attorney General, Cash Michaels, one of our favorite journalists and filmmakers, John Hood, syndicated columnist and author, and Becky Gray, Vice President of the John Locke Foundation. We'll begin our uninterrupted debate after these brief messages from our underwriters.
In more than 21 years on NC Spin, I never endorsed a product or sponsor, but I volunteered to do this message for family physicians. Over the past 40 years, my family doctor could quickly diagnose my illnesses because he knew my medical history. Evidence suggests I'll live longer, have a higher quality of life, and save 33% on health care costs. I believe in my trusted relationship with my family physician.
Family Physicians, your trusted health care advisor for life.
Life's busy, but you're in control. As an electric cooperative member, you have access to lots of tools to help manage your home energy use and budget so you can focus on what's most important.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com.
We now return to NC Spin.
Let's get started. There were two big education developments this week. Let's start with a Superior Court judge tasked with implementing the Leandro lawsuit said North Carolina's pre-K through 12 public education system leaves too many students behind, especially students of color and economically disadvantaged students. Judge David Lee gave a 60-day deadline for a new plan, what will be done about a consultant's report. Meanwhile, we learned that teachers are considering a strike for better pay. Rufus, let's begin with the talk about the possible strike first. No question, teachers were very upset about the fact that there was no new budget approved and they received no pay increases. But state law says they can't go on strike. As former Attorney General, what's your reaction to this proposal?
Well, it's on the books, there's no doubt about it, and it prescribes a misdemeanor for doing so, but there's been no evidence ever that anyone's been prosecuted for it. Now, I don't think there's any possibility. You use the word probable. I think. That's a good way to describe possible strike, because it's not only the law, it's what would happen to the teachers otherwise. Reprimands, firing in some cases. So I don't really see it happening. Or if they do, they'll find some way to parse the word strike so that it doesn't contravene the law.
Becky, let me drill down on this. NCAE is the group that has been polling teachers to find out, A, would they be in favor of doing this, and how many days off from work would they be willing to take?
The teacher union.
Yeah, but NCAE only represents 5% of the teachers in North Carolina. So would the strike have any chance of success if other teachers don't join NCAE?
Well, I think that's the important thing to understand. When we say teachers and teachers are unhappy and those kind of things, you know, that includes a lot of people. It's a very small number of teachers who are part of this, as you're saying. So, you know, I don't know what the effect will have. I tell you one thing, when you're talking about this, and I understand the question from the NCAE to teachers is, would you be willing to strike for one day, or would you be willing to strike for 5 days? You know, nobody's checking with the parents. You're talking about, you know, single parents, working families that, you know, count on their children being in school during the school day are going to be left in the lurch if this happens. You know, what are they supposed to do with this? Not to mention the responsibility that we have to educate children, and that means having teachers in the classroom.
But, Cash, I don't think there's any question about the fact that a large number of teachers, NCAE may not, they may be members of NCAE, but a large number of teachers are very concerned and upset about this. They're wanting a 5% pay raise. Mm-hmm. They want $15 minimum per hour pay for all people in the school systems. And, by the way, they want Medicaid expansion. Sounds like they've bought all in so far as Governor Cooper's plans and proposals. Is that accurate?
Well, you know, listening to Becky, as she talks about all of the parents who don't have a say in this, she neglected to point out that many of those teachers are parents too. And they want to keep a roof over their child's head, and they feel they're not making enough. And so the governor right now is talking about giving them more money, and that's what they want, and they'll do whatever they have to do to get it.
Now, the legislature gave them pay raise in their budget, gave them pay raises. It wasn't the 5% that they were asking for, but it was a pay raise. John, other states have tried this maneuver so far as going on strikes are concerned. What's been the results?
It works better when there's a union with collective bargaining authority and it's not illegal to strike. I mean, I think the Rufus's point is quite true. The fact that it is illegal is not the whole problem. It's only part of the problem. The real problem, as Becky was getting at, is if they chose this tactic, and I, by the way, do not think NCAE is foolish enough to do this. I really don't. I mean, I'm damning them with faint praise, but I think they've made a lot of poor decisions, but I don't think they'll make this one, because last year they did a one-day thing that was a kind of a walkout, kind of a strike. They sort of finagled on the language, as Rufus was getting at, to avoid the criticism of it being illegal. But if they did multiple days, parents would be furious, and they would not. Most North Carolina parents are not closely following the tos and fros of budget negotiations between the legislature and Governor Cooper. They would be, and they, probably most people want teachers to get more money, of course, but they would be very angry if they were left holding the bag here, and it would be very obvious who caused it, and I just don't think it would be a good play for them.
Politically, Rufus, could this backfire on Governor Cooper and the Democrats if they did, in fact, go? I mean, would teachers lose support from the public in this process?
Well, I feel like for sure it would infuriate the legislature, and that would sense that they're not going to give them any more money. And if they it conjures up, like John said and Becky said, when parents have to change their schedule, their babysitting for their younger children, it creates a very, very bad situation of ill will, and I think it could very well backfire. Now, the one good thing they're asking for, I firmly believe that you ought to pay a living wage of $15 to the helpers in the school, and that's the shame about the school system, that the people that serve the meals, that clean up the messes, they get paid virtually nothing.
Okay, so very quickly, let me just go around and ask you, and I want very brief opinions. Let's empathize a bit with the teachers in the situation that they're in. They want, and many people believe they deserve, better pay than what they are receiving, although, what is it, average pay is $54,000 a year for a teacher now, I think, as I understand
and
it.
And if you put benefits on top of that, it's considerably more. Those benefits are worth about
$16,000 additional. My question is, if the strike is not the right way to approach this, to get support, what is?
I believe they should follow the lead of the State Employees Association, which understands that Raleigh's become a bipartisan town. There's people in power who are Democrats, people in power who are Republicans, and the state employees, unlike the Teachers Association, state employees have been finding allies on both sides, and they haven't threatened to strike. I think that's a better strategy.
Interesting. Rufus?
First of all, they need to do away with the word strike totally. That conjures up something very unnice for
North Carolina. It's kind of an unnatural kind of.
It's just unnatural word. Yeah. You don't use it. And I think they have to, parents have to be convinced that the teachers are worth it. And I'm a former teacher, and I have great sympathy for them. And I think they ought to have a raise.
All right. Cash, what do you think?
I think the teachers need to do a better job of getting their plight out, getting the reality of what they're suffering under out. This way, then parents can understand when it happens, because they have no leverage otherwise.
Becky?
I think we all agree good teachers need to be paid well. I don't think there's any question about that. I think it's worth reminding folks that teachers have gotten 5 consecutive pay increases. The 6th and 7th was scheduled in this budget that the governor vetoed and was able to hold that Democratic caucus to not override the veto. 3.9% raise is not 5%, but it's not nothing either. And if they were able to override the governor's veto, that would go into effect.
But all of this kind of speaks to the topic of education reform in North Carolina. And we've talked about this quite a bit. Judge Lee ruled last week that a plan had to be developed within the next 60 days. He said that, as we said on the beginning, it is very obvious that we are not doing the job of providing the constitutional mandate. Rufus, you're our resident attorney and former Attorney General of North Carolina. Does David Lee have the authority to mandate that the legislature do something here?
Well, of course he doesn't. And this is separate. Always, the Landrieu case has always given me a big problem about separation of powers. Now, who would ever dream that that a judge would tell the legislature they have to appropriate money? It just doesn't work that way. And I have heard all the debates on education. I've never heard the legislature one time mention the Leandro case in my existence on this earth.
If they didn't hear Howdy Manning yelling about it, then
no, they didn't. And the governor set up a new commission. What good's that going to do?
Now, Cash, okay. Rufus raises a good question here. Terry Stoops, particularly with the John Locke Foundation, your organization, says that the judge doesn't have the constitutional authority. There are others on the other side that says the court has every right to act when constitutional rights are being violated. And the judge says these constitutional rights to have an adequate education in North Carolina are being violated. Would you take one side or another of that argument?
I believe that this case has been going on, since 1994. Republicans have been in charge of the General Assembly since 2011. I don't know what they've done that's measurable that fixes any of this. So they've ignored it. One of the reasons why you probably haven't heard it is because they've ignored it. So now everybody's going to complain about the fact that the judge is telling them to spend money that they've really not been spending. In fact, there's a lot of argument they've been cutting money from education.
Well, the legislators are saying that they are raising the amount of money being spent on education every single year in every single budget. Now, this West Ed report says that when you factor in the cost of inflation, that the truth of the matter is per pupil spending on education has actually declined 6% since 29. How significant a factor is this per pupil spending and this inflation?
It is the critical part of the separation of powers dispute that Rufus was talking about. You could believe that we should spend $8 billion more collectively on public schools, as the West Ed report recommends, or you could believe it should be $4 billion or $12 billion or $16 billion. Now, that is a decision for elected legislators to make. At best, what Judge Lee can do is force the governor, who is apparently in the consent, and the governor's appointees, to come up with some proposal that comports with the West Ed consult. But the legislature is essentially not represented in the conversation. As far as I know, they cannot be mandated to enact a single additional dollar just because some Superior Court judge says they have to. But there are many people who disagree. Lots of Democrats disagree. This is an emerging constitutional
crisis.
John,
you raise a very good point here, because the judge said he wanted the parties to come back within 60 days with a plan. Unfortunately, the legislature was not one of those parties.
Exactly, and therein lies a big part of this problem. If you read Judge Lee's order, the consent order, the General Assembly is only mentioned in that order just a couple of times. They are left out of this discussion entirely. The other thing is this West Ed report has been apparently thus far just accepted across the board as this is what we're going to do. Every fact included in that report is true, is the assumption with this. And so they're proceeding that way without looking at other research, other sources, bringing other people in. They're just accepting this report that's done from an outfit out of California and saying, well, this is what we're going to do, and you have to do it within 60 days. And the whole notion of the money, I found this interesting, too. So what this consent order says is you have to spend $8 billion more over 8 years. What it doesn't say is, what are we spending and how might we reallocate some of those funds,
well,
spend those in a different way.
It did address
changing the formula. Add, if you've got a problem just adding more money to it after looking at this since, as Cash pointed out, since 1994, that doesn't fix the systemic problems that we have.
But the inescapable point, Rufus, is we are not providing the sound basic education our Constitution allows for. Problem is, what is that sound basic education and how do you get there what do you do?
It's very nebulous. May I point out, too, that one of the great axioms of the legal system, you learn it in the first course in law school, is courts do not issue orders that can't be enforceable. I know no way this could be enforceable. Are you going to hold the entire General Assembly in contempt? Are you going to hold the governor in contempt? Who makes the remedy the best here, and there's no way to enforce it?
Cash, Rufus is right. We're setting up for a showdown here, are we not?
Let's have it. Because what leverage do we have over the legislature?
If
then we're in trouble. We remain in trouble. We hold on to
the biggest leverage we got is at the ballot box. Isn't that correct?
This thing started in 1994 when Democrats were in charge. So it seems like it makes no difference.
This was a unanimous Supreme Court decision, but it's what we call hortatory. It's a suggestion.
Yeah.
And that's about all there is to it. And I'm not knocking my dear friend, former Chief Justice Burley Mitchell, who handed down the decision. It was a decision that has no enforceable factors in it.
As evidenced by the fact that Burley told Howdy Manning that you'll probably retire with this issue still on your plate.
And he tried to.
And he did, finally. Right. Oh, let's switch gears. Monday was Martin Luther King Day. A 2018 column in the Charlotte Observer remarked that King was not a well-liked man for his civil rights stances. Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest found out what that was like when he spoke to an ML King Day breakfast in Raleigh. In his remarks, he claimed one of the main reasons Planned Parenthood was created was to destroy the whole black race. Cash, let's begin by asking your reactions to Dan Forrest.
Yeah,
I would, yes. You got to handle this one.
Which question are you asking me?
Your reactions to Dan Forrest's remarks.
There. Okay. Just go with this, and this way I'm safe. That's all I'm going to do.
Our people listening to the podcast didn't get that.
Okay,
but anyway,
okay.
It was a thumbs down.
Thumb down, yeah.
But as
far as your initial question about race relations, I think if Dr. King were here now, he would not be pleased with the fact that we're still dealing with many of the traditional issues that were here when he walked the earth. Police brutality. So folks trying to suppress the vote. Civil rights issues still being at the fore. I think he would be pleased with some of the advancement we've seen as far as our African Americans in business and education, et cetera, et cetera. But the long and short of it is we're in trouble. We're still in trouble.
John, there's some people who say that what the lieutenant governor expressed was a sort of conspiracy theory that is floating around some circles. Would you agree or disagree about this Planned Parenthood thing?
There is truth in the statement that there were people during the time Margaret Sanger and the Planned Parenthood movement came about. There were people who were associated with that movement who were eugenicists.
Yeah.
Some of them embraced not just birth control, but sterilization and abortion as part of the eugenics project. It's not as clear that Margaret Sanger did, though she said some pretty questionable things about race and about eugenics at the time, probably attempting to get allies among. I mean, she even spoke to the KKK at one point. So she's got some problematic comments. I do think the lieutenant governor went too far to suggest that Planned Parenthood as an organization had as its origin point or one of its main purposes to destroy the black race. I think that's an overstatement of the truth. There were people at the time who did have nefarious racist views, and that informed the eugenics.
He would not back down from those comments, though, Becky.
Well, I think it's because of, you know, what John said is, I mean, there is, you know, history that indicates that those kind of comments were made at the beginning of Planned Parenthood. So, yeah, his point was Planned Parenthood was started for this particular reason. It's a little bit of a stretch, but it is based in some facts, some historical facts that are out there.
Okay, I'm going to ask if you can connect the dots. Here was his rationale in his speech. He said that his daughter was studying genetics in school, as most school children do, specifically dominant and recessive genes. He went on to say that skin color is a dominant and recessive gene trait, and that it's what the civil rights battle was all about. I thought it was a very unusual speech to be made on Martin Luther King Day, but does he connect the dots there?
I don't connect any. I put it this way. I don't understand what the gentleman was talking about.
What was his point?
I think he was trying to say that skin color and other characteristics are just like height and weight, and they're just genetic, and there isn't any moral weight to them. I mean, he was making an anti-racist point. The challenge here, though, was the there are absolute true elements to the critique that eugenics had a racist element, that had a racist intent among many people, and that people who supported from birth control to sterilization to abortion had some of those views. I just think you can't assume they all did.
Yeah, but one of the things we're leaving out, though, is that some of the supporters of Margaret Sanger included Coretta Scott King.
That's well, right. Not only W.E.B. Du Bois, but the NAACP, yes. the NAACP has been a big supporter of Planned Parenthood and through the years.
It's important to remember that Margaret Sanger was a birth control advocate. She was not actually an abortion advocate.
Let's go back to this Charlotte Observer column. I was sort of intrigued. They reprinted it in the News and Observer this week. The Charlotte O says, "We are coming to observe a cuddly Martin Luther King instead of the fighter that he was during the 50s and 60s, and many of us who lived through that. Have we distorted the image and the work of what he did, Becky?"
I think, you know, with great leaders like that and historically, you know, there is some distortion from the reality of their day-to-day life and then how we remember them and what we remember them for and the influence that they have through the years. You know, as you mentioned, I mean, you know, during his day, Martin Luther King was a human being like the rest of us and had flaws and was, you know, prickly, I think, in some circumstances. And, you know, everybody didn't love him. But, you know, the further that you get and the more that you remember his legacy and what he left, you pick the good things, and there's certainly plenty of good things to pick from that.
I don't think there's any question about the fight that he had for civil rights and minorities in the country and in our state. He did his, I Have a Dream speech. The first time he did it was in Rocky Mount, as a matter of fact. So where does the civil rights fight today, Rufus? How would you define race relations in North Carolina today?
Well, they're better than most states, I think. I think the big battle is suppression of voting rights. That's the one that lingers there all the time. And I don't understand the rationale when you have, I recall no instances whatsoever of any voting irregularities or people voting that weren't supposed to vote when I was Attorney General, and that was 12 years.
I don't think there's any question, Cash, that racial relations are better today than they were back in the 60s, perhaps, in the 70s.
Well, that's relevant.
But I get this feeling that there's a tension here, that just under the surface of everything, there is a tension that's going on so far as race relations are concerned, and it wouldn't take much to set it off.
And a man in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue doesn't help any either.
Yeah. Yeah, so far as it goes. Is there a moral voice today in North Carolina or in the nation that would perhaps be the person to take MLK's place? Some people say that William Barber might be that person with his Poor People's Campaign.
Well, I think with Cash Michaels on the scene, who else do you need? Cash Michaels and NC Spin is more than enough as a moral leader.
Well, there's no question about the fact that he is. It was no accident that you were on our show
on Martin Luther King.
Yeah. Because under the circumstances, I think this is an issue in North Carolina. It's something that we need to be addressing. Is the nation willing to hear civil rights discussions today, Becky? I mean, we've gotten so partisan.
I think absolutely. And I think that, you know, across the nation and right here in North Carolina, we are. You know, one thing that really struck me as I was preparing for the show and kind of reviewing Martin Luther King's life, and, you know, one thing that struck me is through his career and through his movement in civil rights and his leadership of that, you know, he recognized that, you know, through that there were other issues, there were other things that came. You know, Cash has mentioned, you know, affordable housing, police brutality, education, you know, all of those things. That
healthcare,
yeah. You know, all of it. And so, you know, as we approach challenges, I think we need to be inclusive and look at all of this and how this affects all populations.
I will have to tell you that if you have anywhere close to an open mind, go to Birmingham and go to the Civil Rights Museum down there. It is one moving experience.
when you see Bull Connors with the fire hoses back in the civil rights movement days, it will make a difference in the way you think about things. Let's move on to ask you to tell us something we don't know. Cash.
I'll tell you something I didn't know. I did not know that my colleague here, John Hood, was a tap dance teacher. And would love to see video of this. I cannot.
One show, we're just going to have John performing.
I really want
That's
to see this.
Every show.
Rufus Edmondson, tell us something we don't know.
Performing in 1984, I sang Too Much Honky Tonk Angel, and that didn't turn out too well. So
that your comments about barbecue. Becky Gray, tell us something we don't know.
Well, you know, the short legislative session is right around the corner, as much as we don't even want to think about it. But I'm kind of hearing rumblings that they may be considering three different constitutional amendments. One, to put some rules in place for redistricting, actually enshrine that in the Constitution. One, to secure property rights under eminent domain, and another one to put into our Constitution that would restrain the growth of state government or the state budget.
John, tell us something we don't know.
North Carolina made international news this week. A Mitchell County animal shelter advertised Perdita the cat as the worst cat in the world. Please adopt this cat. And I sympathize. I understand.
You're an animal.
Let me just tell you something real quick about this. Their point was just we want it to go somewhere else where it can't cause trouble. I think Perdita is running for lieutenant governor.
Yeah, we gotta dog it out of here. You've heard our spin on the issues of the day. To stay informed all during the week, please sign up for our free weekly email newsletter. Give your feedback and read our weekly column. Visit our website, ncspin.com, or catch NCSpin on Facebook. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast. And join us next week when we'll have more balanced debate for the Old North State. Until then, stay informed and watch out for the spin.
In more than 21 years on NC Spin, I never endorsed a product or sponsor, but I volunteered to do this message for family physicians. Over the past 40 years, my family doctor could quickly diagnose my illnesses because he knew my medical history. Evidence suggests I'll live longer, have a higher quality of life, and save 33% on health care costs. I believe in my trusted relationship with my family physician.
Family Physicians, your trusted health care advisor for life.
Life's busy, but you're in control. As an electric cooperative member, you have access to lots of tools to help manage your home energy use and budget, so you can focus on what's most important.
Join us next week and get the spin on issues facing our state. For more information or to learn how to contact us, visit our website, ncspin.com. NC Spin is a copyrighted production of Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated.